Mr. Rose, Rail 5. Now, we were talking about your time at the Mons establishment. You were going to tell a story when we were interrupted about your report, a very short report. If you'd like to continue.
Yeah, I claim to have the shortest report in the history of the British Army, because at the halfway point of the 10-week gunnery course, we did some tests and then a report was written, and my battery commander report on me was just one word: thick. And I don't think anybody could have a shorter report than that. And when I was marched up in front of the battery commander, because of course, remember, I'm 24, I'm a qualified solicitor, and he says to me, "Now look here, Rose," he said, "you seem to be a pretty intelligent sort of fellow. What's the devil's the meaning of this report, thick?" And I said, "Well, sir," I said, "I spent 5 years working in a solicitor's office," I said, "where the whole of the training was not to make hurried decisions and to think about everything slowly and carefully. I said, and from the minute that I hit Mons Officer Cadet School, you want everything decided by yesterday. I said, and I'm having difficulties in adjusting." He said, "All right, if that's the best you can do, dismiss." And I marched out.
Now, where we got to was you had in fact passed, whereas your friend, I've forgotten his name, but had failed.
Yes, I passed, I got 51 out of 100. And the pass mark was 50, and he got 49. So he was put back and had to restart the 10-week course. But in fact, he reckoned that was good, because he did very well going around the second time, and he became junior under officer and got posted off to the Royal Horse Artillery.
Now, what about you? What happened to you? What was the actual... Was there a commissioning ceremony? Tell us about that.
Oh, yes. Commissioning ceremony is quite impressive. My mother and father and my sister came up to watch it.
A parade, was it?
Yes, so it was the whole school paraded. And when I was there, you're talking about 300 cadets, and you all sort of marched about and presented arms and sloped arms. And then come the very end, the passing out troop, you slow marched off the square, and you slow marched up to the podium where the general taking the parade was, and you went round each side of the podium, and then you slow marched up the steps, and as you peeled off at the top of the steps, you were a second lieutenant.
And that was would that be December or January?
That was January.
57.
January of 57.
And was there any element of choice in what unit you were to go to? Or you hadn't passed very high, so I presume there wouldn't be much choice. But
you didn't get a choice, strictly speaking, but you were invited to state your preferences. From memory now, you had Middle East, Far East, Germany, or a home posting, UK posting. I said, "Well, I don't mind where I go as long as it's abroad." I didn't want to do my national service in England.
And why not?
Well, I'd seen so many of my friends, and they all sort of came home Friday night and went back Sunday night. And it seemed to me that they never fully got into it. I thought, if I'm going to be a soldier, I might as well be a soldier and, of course, see a bit of the world. Because, you know, one didn't travel to anything like the degree that youngsters do today. So I thought, you know, take some advantage out of it and see the world.
And what happened? Where were you posted?
Well, I was posted initially to Germany, to 29th Field Regiment, which was in British Army of the Rhine, in Dusseldorf. So I wrote the standard letter to the colonel saying that I was being posted to his regiment, and I got a letter back telling me that although they were at that moment in Germany, they would be coming back to England, and the regiment was going to Cyprus in the June.
So what happened?
So I went to Germany and had 3 fairly drunken months.
Now, what about the journey out? Anything of note, or was it just a stone?
Oh, yes. I mean, the first thing, it's very difficult to explain the transformation in one's life from being 2331815 Gunner Roth, being 2nd Lieutenant J.H. Roth, Royal Artillery. And I remember we travelled to London, we had to report to Woolwich Depot, and I met up with another officer who'd been on the same course as me, who lived in Portsmouth, and we met together. We had to travel in uniform, but of course we had first class warrants now. And I remember when we got to Waterloo, suddenly there was all these regimental policemen saluting us. And so instead of seeing a red cap and diving for the nearest cover, suddenly there you were being saluted, and it came as an enormous kind of shock. Quite enjoyable, I have to say, but a shock nonetheless. And then we got to Woolwich, and I remember we reported, and we were a couple of things, I can't remember exactly what they were. And then the chap said, right, fellows, he said, the rest of the day is yours. Make sure you're at King's Cross Station at 6:30. And the idea that you were trusted and expected to get yourself there was so novel after 7 or 8 months of being allowed not even to think. Was really quite remarkable. And then, of course, the journey out was, we went troop train up to Harwich across to the Hook of Holland, and then train across Holland to Germany. And as an officer now, of course, you're travelling first class, and people are seeing to your luggage, you know, the world had changed.
What were your first impressions when you got to Dusseldorf to join the 29th?
Well, the first thing, of course, was the quality of the accommodation, because 29th Field Regiment were in a barracks called Carnarvon Barracks.
Carnarvon,
as in Wales. And they were the former Luftwaffe quarters, right alongside Dusseldorf Airport. And the quality of the accommodation was very good indeed for everybody. I mean, even down to the lowliest little gunner. And the officers, we had a superb officers' mess, and although I was a junior second lieutenant, I had my own sitting room bedroom.
So can you describe your rooms, your barrack rooms?
Gosh, you're pushing me a bit now. There was a block which was the general quarters. And you had the very large dining room, and upstairs there was a very large sitting room and sort of other facilities. And then you had accommodation blocks on each side, where those officers that were living in. Of course, a lot of the officers lived out, all the married ones that were out in married quarters. And it was all very palatial. And as I say, I had my own sitting room and bedroom
as well as a
very junior second lieutenant. And we shared I think from memory there was a bathroom between about bathroom facilities between four of us. But I mean, compared to what one had been surviving in over the previous 8 months, you know, this was luxury indeed.
And what was the officers' mess like? Can you describe that? I mean, the actual, you know, not the sort of block, but I mean the actual officers' mess rooms themselves.
Certainly in Carnarvon Barracks, very comfortable. The very large, magnificent dining room. And I remember when we gave our last dinner night before we left Germany, and all the regimental silver, and the table, enough to seat 50 people each side. I mean, it was very impressive in this very high vaulted room. All the regimental silver, quite magnificent. I remember sitting there on that dinner night, imagining all the Luftwaffe pilots sitting there with Hermann Göring at the top end of the table.
Now, what was your reception like when you joined the unit, from the colonel, the adjutant, and your battery? I mean, I'm not sure which battery you were put into, but...
Eight ALMA, A-L-M-A, after the Battle of ALMA. Apparently the battery was known as ALMA Battery, because they beat the Royal Horse Artillery into action at the Battle of the Alma, which our battery commander was always at great pains to remind us. And our battery, I can't think of the word, was a black square. So we were known as Black Eight. The reception, very friendly. As I say, of course, when I arrived, I was startled to discover that other than the doctor, I was the only National Service officer, which was a rather interesting experience. But yeah, everybody friendly.
Were you brief? I mean, was it a formal or a formal welcome from the battery commander, from the colonel?
No, I arrived. Late afternoon, from memory. Was met at the station. Somebody came down in a jeep and met me and drove me to the barracks and up to the officers' mess. And I went in. There was a mess sergeant, and he was the one who really met me, showed me my room, so forth. And then I, early evening, went up, you know, and had my first sort of gin and tonic as a brand new officer in the officers' mess. And then saw the adjutant and interviewed with the colonel on the following morning.
Do you remember any impressions from those interviews?
Not really. Nothing that strikes me very significantly.
Now, what about this question generally of you being welcome or not welcome or as a national service officer? I mean, because not all regulars are too keen on national service officers. I mean, I'm not trying to promote that. How did you feel you were received as the only national service officer?
I felt completely welcome from the very word go. I was never aware of any antagonism of any shape or form towards me.
You weren't cut out of things, or
not at all.
You were made welcome.
Absolutely, and I felt entirely welcome from day one.
Can we talk a little about the nature of the officers' mess as it was run? What did the officers' mess provide for you in the evening?
Well, in Germany, of course.
That's what I mean, yes.
Yes, in Germany. And, of course, one must remember that we were in a slightly unusual situation because this was a regiment that had been in Germany for a number of years but was now in the process of getting ready to return to England and then go to Cyprus. So, in fact, it was already beginning to run down, and it was beginning to hand in equipment. And this was an enormous revelation as to the whole system of the army and stores. And
well, let's talk about that. Tell me about this process.
Well, I didn't realise it, but when I arrived on the first morning, the next morning, when I see the adjutant and I say, and I'm formally interviewed by the colonel, I was asked to sign for my troop, because although I was expecting to be the third officer in the troop, this is Bravo Troop, B Troop, in fact, I was the permanent second officer, the gun position officer, and actually acting troop commander. So I signed all these bits of papers, and I only subsequently discovered I'd signed for about £1 million worth of equipment, which was sort of four guns and lorries and you name it. As I say, I'm acting troop commander, which came as a slight shock to me, as I'd only been trained to be a humble troop leader. But not a lot was going on. As I say, the whole operation was being run down with a view to the regiment moving. And, of course, what had happened is that over the years, this regiment, 29th Field, had accumulated an enormous amount of surplus stores, bakshis, as they were famously called. And the thing was that you were not allowed to admit that you had acquired items additional to what was indented out to you as a regiment. So the quartermaster, the regimental quartermaster, and then the battery commanders of each battery, who were really the battery quartermasters, were trying to offload as much of this equipment as they could, because we only had three railway trucks to bring it all back. The tragic thing to me, and the first thing that underlined my growing sense of the general injustice of the world, was that on the one hand, all the soldiers' inventories were being checked, and they were being charged a shilling if they were a cap badge short. Now, this to a chap who's earning 28 shillings a week, no, this is big money. At the same time, we were, and I actually was in command of a lorry that was driven out onto a bridge over the River Wine, and we were throwing 19 radio sets into the river because they were surplus, Nobody else wanted them, and we didn't dare leave them behind, and we had no room to take them back to England. So there were these poor soldiers throwing away thousands of pounds worth of equipment into the river and going back and finding they'd been docked a shilling for a lost cap bag. And as you can imagine, among the soldiery, there was a fairly high sense of injustice. And the whole thing about stores and signing and so forth was incredible. The whole army ran on it, it seemed to me. And of course, then we had the great saga, and I'm going ahead a little bit, after we had staged in England,
I'll
of barrack damages.
I will come to that.
Come
definitely.
To that, right.
Was there any question of barrack damages in Germany? Were you aware of it going on there?
Because I wasn't so aware of it then, because
well,
of course
I'll leave it to when you're in England.
I was fairly new. I mean, I'm sure it was all going on, but I was not so aware of it. And it was only as I became more experienced and began to recognise the ways that the army worked that it became more apparent to me.
So what was your daily routine like when you first joined? We'll come back to the mess later.
Well,
in this first period, I mean, how would you spend your day, you know?
Trying to fill it, because the whole regiment, in a sense, was scaling down because of the pending move, and I spent a lot of the time wandering about trying to find something to do, really.
Now, how did you establish the relationship? You were acting troop commander,
yeah,
as a very junior. You couldn't be,
yeah,
more junior, second, yeah, lieutenant.
Yeah.
How important did you feel it was to establish a good relationship with your troop sergeant major, or whatever the rank was, I'm not quite sure, sergeant,
yeah,
troop sergeant.
No, troop sergeant major.
Troop sergeant major. I mean, I don't know whether you remember his name.
Artillery batteries have three sergeant majors, as opposed to infantry companies, which only have one. You have the battery sergeant major, and then the two troops, the two gun troops, each have a sergeant major as well.
Tell me, was it important? Who was your troop sergeant major? You might not remember. But
I do. Troop sergeant major Goddard.
Goddard?
Goddard. And...
Now, what type of a man was he?
Oh, he was a splendid character. And I'll tell you my first... I tell you my first meeting with him, because I remember it with complete clarity. I was sitting in the battery office. I think this is... I'm pretty certain this was actually my first full day. And I'm sitting in the battery office wondering what in the name of God I was supposed to do. And through the door came this very tall, he must have been 6'2", very smart, crashing salute, two rows of medals, starting with the British Empire medal. And he introduced himself, Troop Sergeant Major Goddard, sir, orders please. And I thought, ah. So I said to him, Sergeant Major, I said, at ease and sit down, and I pulled out cigarettes. And I gave him a cigarette, and I said, now, Sergeant Major, I said, this is very important, I said, because here I am, troop commander. I said, and here you are, Troop Sergeant Major. I said, and you've learned more about, know more about the army than I've forgotten more about the army than I shall ever know. And I know, and you know, that you're running this troop, and I have no plans to interfere with that at all. I only ask one thing. I said, tell me what's going on, so if the battery commander asks me a question, I can answer it. And he gave me a big grin, and he said, you and I are going to get on fine, sir. And he never let me put a foot wrong from that day forward. I had no trouble at all.
And he didn't in any way try and show you up?
No.
I mean, you know, because...
From that moment, he guarded my back. I didn't try and bullshit him, and he took that on board straight away. And if ever I was about to do something, and I mean, this becomes much more relevant when we get to Cyprus.
we'll follow this idea.
He guarded my back. He'd sidle up alongside. I wouldn't do that, sir, if I were you. I'd say, right, hold fire. Why is that, Sergeant Major? And then he would explain to me the pit that I was about. And I have to say that I saw a lot of other junior officers allowed, because they were cocky and pulled the... fall into great big pits where their sergeant or the sergeant major could have saved their bacon, but didn't, because they were cocky little know-alls, and he was quite prepared to see them fall in the pit.
And possibly even dig it for them.
He
must have been old. I mean, these were Second World War medals.
Yes.
So he was at least...
Age, he must have been coming, he must have been 40, he must have been coming up to 40.
So a good 15 or 16 years older than
you. Oh yes, yes. Not quite old enough to be my father, but not all that far short of it. Incredibly experienced soldier. I mean, you know, he must have had getting on for 20 years service under his belt, you know, and here he was, warrant officer, so forth.
Now, did you have a similar, what about your troop sergeants? I presume there were two or three, well, yeah, one per gun at least, and, you know. Did you have a similarly open relationship,
yeah,
with them, or
yeah,
how did you get on with them?
Well, I basically, I from the word go, I didn't try to impress upon them that because I was an officer that somehow I knew better. I mean, I didn't. I was very conscious. I'm here. These are all professional full-time soldiers, all very experienced. I got 10 weeks not very effective gunnery training at Mons, you see. And I just simply didn't try to in any way say to them, look, you know, I know better than you.
Did you maintain more of your rank, you know, the status of rank with the sergeants? I mean, you didn't open yourself up quite as much as you had with the troop sergeant major.
No, except the football sergeant, because the battery commander put me in charge of the battery football team, which was quite a good team actually at that time.
All come to this, yeah.
And the sergeant in charge of that was Sergeant Boardman. I'm actually amazed that I remember all these names, but he was called Boardman, and he appeared within a day or two and said, I understand you're the football officer, sir. I said, exactly right, Sergeant. I said, the bad news from your point of view is that I've never played soccer in my life. I've always been a rugby player. I said, but the good news is that I'm going to leave you to carry on running the soccer team. And I said, all I want you to do is each Monday morning tell me what's going on for the rest of the week, so if the battery commander asks me, I can tell him. And he said, that sounds good to me, sir. And each Monday morning, he used to produce me, used to come in, and he'd say, we're playing 3rd Field Squadron Royal Engineers at Mönchengladbach on Wednesday afternoon. And I say, yes, okay, I'll be there to cheer the team on. And he said, we're doing PT, yes, tomorrow afternoon. And then the battery commander would say to me, what are we doing, John? And I would very pull out my piece of paper, and he would be very impressed. And we won the minor units league, British Army of the Rhine, and the battery commander thought I was a splendid fellow, and I actually did nothing. I really didn't. I just used to go and cheer on Wednesday afternoon.
How about the men themselves? I mean, you'd been in another rank not long before. How did you get on with them?
Well, at the risk now of sounding, I may now be going into the becoming very boastful, and I don't mean to be, but I had a rather extraordinary relationship with the ordinary soldiers. I think a lot of this came from, of course, being by this time nearly 25. But also, of course, I'd had a 6 years experience working in a solicitor's office. I spent the larger part of that working in the criminal field. I'd spent weeks in prisons interviewing clients and so forth. And I think I had a rather greater understanding of people, perhaps, than probably the majority of officers, regular as well as national service. And I always had a remarkably good relationship with the soldiers, and indeed the battery captain, a very senior captain called Roy Gunn, said he'd never seen anything quite like it.
What was it based on, do you think? I mean, experience, I accept that, but what had experience taught you that enabled you to get on so well?
Well, I think what it was is that I was, that I had the knack of being able to be friends and to win their confidence without ceasing to be an officer. And Roy Gunn, the battery captain, remarked on this particularly, because a rather remarkable thing happened at a later stage when I was moved from B Troop, Bravo Troop. I was moved out of that and put into the battery headquarters, and the all the soldiers clubbed together and gave me a cigarette lighter. And Roy Gunn said he'd never known that, ever.
Now, how did you? Was it just
I hope this doesn't sound too boastful.
No. It's just
the way that it happened.
It's me that's asking and probing it. So, to you, it was just a knack, you feel? There's no way you can sort of explain how you did it? Because it is difficult to avoid becoming overly familiar if you're friendly with them, I believe.
I think it is a knack I have, because I think I've been able to achieve exactly the same thing with all the staff and all the courts. And, you know, even though now I'm a highly senior judge, I like to think that everybody in the court actually likes me, they enjoy working with me, we're great friends, and yet I still am the judge, and they're the clerk.
But there's not, you can't sort of encapsulate in a couple of tips as to how to do it.
I can't. I really, really can't.
No, that's okay.
I think it's just a knack that I have.
Now, what about your relationship? I mean, we've discussed the ranks below you. What about the ranks above you, by which I do mean, is it Roy Gunn or Ray Gunn? Gunn, was it? The battery captain.
Gosh, I've lost his name. Roy Gunn.
Roy Gunn, yes. He was in charge of the battery, was he?
No.
That's right.
There's a battery commander who's a major.
Let's start generally. Who was the major? Do you recall?
Yes, Charles Porter.
Well, how did you get on him with him?
Very well.
What was he like as a battery commander?
Very good. He was one of the battery officers, he was well liked, and he was a good battery commander.
What made him good?
Again, the ability to be, he was always the battery commander, and yet he was equally, he seemed to have the same knack of being able to be friends with the soldiers in a way that a large number, most officers didn't seem to be able to. And I think he had much the same sort of knack, but he never ceased to be the battery commander. He was always, at the end of the day, Major Porter.
And what about Gunn, Roy Gunn? He'd be captain, I presume.
He was a captain, and he was ex-Indian Army. And he was old for being a captain. I think he had not progressed as far as he might have, because he had come out of the Indian Army and gone back a couple of ranks and had to sort of build up again. He was altogether more complicated character, and I got on with him well enough, but never fully understood him.
What were the areas of complexion in his character? I mean, what type of thing? You don't need to go into it too much. But
well, he was not obviously officer type in one sense, and I think he was more intelligent than a lot of the officers. Of course, he was in charge of all the stores and equipment of the battery, and that the whole of that was a whole gigantic exercise in beating the system anyway, which may have slightly warped my judgment of him. But I remember coming in one day, and he got a pair of binoculars, and I said, "Whatever are you doing to those binoculars?" He said, "I'm forging a number on it," he said, "because we've lost a pair of binoculars, and I'm replacing them with these, and I have to change the number," which I thought was a strange occupation for a senior captain in the British Army, but that's the way it ran.